Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
It's hard on me. It's definitely hard, because I live right there, and anytime I come out the house, I'm going to see that, and that's the first place my eyes go, even if I don't think about it. So, yeah. It's horrible. This is actually horrible.
The site of 1275 Jefferson Avenue, once a symbol of victory after residents fought for a grocery store to come to their neighborhood, is now a trigger for many who live nearby. But it's not only the site of Tops supermarket that evokes trauma for the residents there. It's the site of empty lots and decrepit buildings down Jefferson Avenue. It's the fact that as much as May 14th, 2022 changed the area didn't really change. Droves of people and money flooded Buffalo's East Side, planting seeds of hope for renewal and a community made whole after suffering a racist act of domestic terrorism. Behind podiums and in front of cameras, promises were made. But as the months turned into years, some residents and survivors began asking a tough question. Who really benefited from the money, attention, and goodwill that followed the massacre?
You have community projects that never touch the community or involve people in the community. You have people building careers, brands, reputations, all saying they're helping the people off the East Side, off the pain of Black Buffalo, but they have nothing to show for it.
In part one of Where Did the Money Go?, I discussed the tens of millions of dollars that either reached or were promised to Buffalo's East Side and Black residents. Today, we're moving from the sources of giving to the actual and intended recipients. Who received multiple streams of funding? How are government contracts shaping or holding back progress on the East Side? And why are some residents and survivors saying they're still not getting the help they need from organizations that receive money to serve them? It's time to dig deeper. I'm Ijaz Jasil, and this is What's Next.
If you follow the money, you'll see where the problem is. The problem is the money never trickles down to us. Never.
We started off looking at major financial contributions and promises that flooded the East Side following the massacre. Most of the donations I could track moved through two major funds: the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund, which provided direct financial assistance to victims' families, survivors, and TOPS employees, and the Buffalo Together Fund, which supported nonprofit relief work and longer-term community investment. But where else did the money go? One reason the funds have been so difficult to track is that so many dollars moved through so many local organizations. And following those dollars means also following what services, programs, and resources those organizations actually provided. Before you can measure the impact, you have to know who was funded in the first place. So, how many organizations received money to help survivors and community members? That's harder to answer than it should be. Buffalo Together alone selected 86 organizations to fund, but some nonprofits appeared repeatedly across donation records and funding announcements. I identified groups and initiatives that received post-514 support from three or more major sources.
Even when faced with unimaginable tragedy, and let's be honest, it was colored by hateful racism and despicable violence, you did not return hate with hate.
The massacre wasn't just an act of mass violence. It was a racist attack on Buffalo's Black community. In response, multiple donors directed their giving towards legacy institutions like Buffalo Juneteenth and the African American Cultural Center. Those gifts were part of the broader response to racial harm. However, they fall under a different category than direct aid to victims, survivors, or residents seeking immediate support. But four nonprofits in particular that repeatedly receive funding were working together to serve residents during one of the most urgent periods. The goal? Partnering to provide food and other necessities during the temporary closure of the Jefferson Avenue Top Supermarket.
We're stepping in and stepping up for our community. Thank you. And we want to make sure that people can eat and they have more than just food, though.
These organizations were the Resource Council of Western New York, Buffalo Go Green, Feed More Western New York, and the African Heritage Food Co-op. The Resource Council of Western New York received six notable funding streams that I could account for. One was the widely reported $3 million in state funding earmarked for its operation of the Buffalo United Resiliency Center. But that's not the only funding the state allocated for the social service organization. In public New York State Comptroller records, I found that the State Office of Victim Services had a $10 million contract with the Resource Council of Western New York for the Buffalo Resiliency Center. Those records show spending to date at just over $100,000. The contract record lists the start date of October 1st, 2021, more than 7 months before the 2022 massacre. Retroactive contract dates are not unheard of in New York State grant contracting, but the date raises questions about whether the record reflects an administrative funding period, an amended contract, a data entry issue, or some other explanation. What also remains unclear is what happened to the unspent portion of that contract, and whether any of that money was transferred, reassigned, or otherwise made available to the Community Health Center of Buffalo and the Buffalo Urban League, which, as I previously reported, now jointly operate the Buffalo United Resiliency Center. I called and emailed the Resource Council of Western New York to get some clarification about the contract and why the Resiliency Center changed hands in the first place. I'm still awaiting a response. Buffalo Go Green received grants from the Buffalo Together Fund, the Key Bank Foundation, and the Buffalo Bills and NFL Foundation. I couldn't account for how much each of those grants were, but I do know the nonprofit received $25,000 from a General Mills grant administered by the United Way of Buffalo and Erie County. For Feed More Western New York, I found four large cash donations totaling $260,000. The largest, a $100,000 gift from Delta Sonic. The fourth nonprofit, the African Heritage Food Co-op, wasn't just funded for supporting temporary food distribution. It was funded for Promise, a Black-owned and operated cooperative established in direct response to food apartheid on Buffalo's East Side. After the massacre, the co-op came to represent something larger than emergency aid. It was the possibility of what recovery could look like, both in and of the community. The co-op received grants from Buffalo Together, the Key Bank Foundation, the Buffalo Bills, and NFL Foundation. It also received a $3 million commitment from New York State to help fund its flagship Buffalo location at 238 Carlton Street, a plan in the making since 2019. But today, that building remains vacant, and the co-op's emergency food distribution has slowed from the pace it maintained in the immediate aftermath of the massacre. Why? More importantly, how, with so much financial backing? I asked Reverend Kinzer Pointer, former board president and current CEO of the African Heritage Food Co-op, who told me the nonprofit received about $100,000 total in donations. As for the state funding, he said one major holdup is keeping both the Carlton Street project and the millions of dollars attached to it in limbo. And it has to do with the city.
There was a lot of support that came in post 514, the largest probably being the $3 million in state funding. Have you actually received that money yet? Has the co-op?
No, that funding actually is for the construction. So until I start construction, the money is in place. The state hasn't balked. But until we start construction, then we'll begin to draw down on the $3 million to complete construction. Okay. The state has kept its word. And trust and believe. There are a bunch of things you have to do at the state level, and we've been able to do those. So, and we've not had not one single difficulty as of today. So I'm telling you that this delay right now is entirely the city of Buffalo. And of course, I understood that the city wasn't involved until we had a building permit, because, you know, they give building permits all the time and then financing falls through, so they stopped doing it. But it's got to be a better way to get this done in a more timely order.
And I know that there were other corporate donations that came in to support the co-op during that time, too. There was a $10,000 grant from the General Mills Food Grant. Buffalo Together Fund stepped in, Buffalo Bills, yeah. Key Bank. Were all of those funds used to support what you all were doing at that time or future investments?
No, they were used to, so we couldn't afford to be putting anything away for a rainy day and people are hungry. No, we use those dollars to purchase fruits, vegetables, and then to be present on Jefferson to give them help. And then, later on to work with Pastor Donaldson and his food pantry and make sure that people knew where to go. And in a lot of instances, to take food to people.
About, do you know how many expenses you accrued during that 6-month period where you were giving out those free fruits and vegetables to the community?
Oh, we spent about $200,000.
Okay, so that accounts for like all the grant funding you received. And a lot of those you said were sort of just one-off donations. Did you find that it became harder to provide these services you needed to provide after that initial flood of giving?
Oh, it became pretty impossible. Because, of course, as I said to you, we're not in what we do. We don't do to make money. We do it because the necessity is there. The need is there. And so we are not in the habit of saving money. You know, that's not the purpose of African Heritage. The purpose is to provide to people who can't get it. So we just, you know, I mean, it sounds good when people say, well, you should have been saving. Well, yeah, of course we should have. But we're not independently wealthy. And we're not stealing from anyone. So saving becomes different.
Right. It's about immediately getting those monies and services out the door.
That's right, because their hunger is not going to be down the road. It's today.
That kind of need is as urgent as it was 4 years ago. But although 514 further exposed food insecurity on Buffalo's east side, the impact of the tragedy was never just about food. It exposed other needs too. Mental health care, financial assistance, support for people whose injuries or trauma made it harder to work, and services that were supposed to be available at no cost. Those supports were promised by a number of organizations that received money to help impacted individuals. And for some people, those needs have never gone away. You may remember Grady Lewis from last time, the East Side resident who had a conversation with a stranger on May 13th, 2022. A stranger who, unbeknownst to Grady, would carry out one of the most horrific acts the city of Buffalo had ever seen the very next day. Grady witnessed the attack from the parking lot, but he was deemed ineligible for compensation from the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund on the grounds that law enforcement couldn't verify his presence. He was denied not only financial relief, but an opportunity to heal. Since that day, he's been trying to adapt to a new normal, one that looks nothing like the freedom he had before. Part of that process has meant seeking support from nonprofits that receive generous donations to help people like him. Grady's story puts a face and a voice to something easy to lose in discussions about funding. The community around Jefferson Avenue lost much more than a grocery store that day.
I'm still losing money today. You know, I don't go out. I'm doing other stuff now. I'm painting. I don't paint. I do paint, but now I got to be somewhere. I used to be free. Now I got to schedule this with that later on. I'll catch up with you later. And I'm on back on the plantation again. So this is horrible, being back on the plantation. So, yeah.
His story is also a testament to how resiliency in several contexts can feel less like healing and more like harm to those who live with the aftermath of the massacre every day. And that's why the question of where money went, especially money meant for mental health, trauma support, and direct services, still matters.
I want to be restored. But they want me to be resilient, so when the next time they kick me in the head, I can take it better, get back up again. Well, I'm not free anymore. I can't go out and just collect bottles at night because I've always known that people are dangerous, but now is my eyes are wide open to it. I don't like cars driving past me at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know what this person is gonna do now. Before, I was free, like, I'm okay. Now, after seeing that, I'm not open. And the wild thing is, like, if I was to go to the store at 2 o'clock in the morning around here, I wouldn't be scared. But if I went on Elmwood, I would be. Hurdle would be. It's interesting, actually. I go to counseling. So my counselor said I'm doing better now. But I'm still a little jumpy. I don't like things, you know, a lot of noise. I don't like things moving around me. So I still got that. I love my art therapy that I do on Tuesdays. I didn't think I would want to do it, but actually after doing it, it was like, okay, I get a chance to be free for an hour and a half. So I love doing my art therapy at the Pray program. So yeah, it's changed me. Definitely it's changed me. Actually, somebody said, you scared? And I thought about it for a second. I ain't scared, but I'm scared. Yeah, depending on where you put me at. You know, I'm around, certain people, yeah. I don't know what they gonna do because of what I saw. That was just the most scariest thing I've ever seen in my life. But at that point in time when it was happening, I thought it was a movie. I didn't think it was real. I thought, okay, they filming a movie because they make movies here in Buffalo. So I was thinking, okay, it's a movie. That's how my brain still registered until he went into the store. That's when I realized that, no, okay, this is real. He's really shooting people. This is real. And then it changes. So yeah, it's ugly, actually. Yes. And I laugh a lot of times. I notice when I start talking about that, will keep me from crying, actually. So yeah, so I laugh a lot. One of my favorite laughs is when I was questioning him, he asked me two questions and two of them to make a difference. And when he said, are you gonna be here tomorrow? I said, yeah, 5 o'clock. I always laugh at that. That's one of my favorite laughs. Cause it was unbelievable, actually. Yeah. Unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
The tragedy and the moments before stayed with him, and the memory of that conversation in the parking lot where he witnessed the attack, and in the help he says he later tried to find. One of the organizations Grady sought help from was the Community Health Center of Buffalo's federally funded Resiliency Center. In 2023, the center was awarded $3,889,303 from the Department of Justice. This funding was for the Resiliency Center to provide a number of services to the immediate community near Top Supermarket, victims' families, survivors as identified by the FBI, and first responders. These services included mental health counseling, case management, and support referrals. The center also promised help around social needs like housing, transportation, food access, and rental and utility arrears. Grady began going to the Center for Mental Health Services, and he says he was told he'd receive other assistance as well. But as he recalls, things shifted once the center had a change in leadership.
We used to have different workshops, different things, game night. They have refreshments. If you want to go down there, there's always some soda or juice or chips. But when Ifisa left, it was pretty much over after that. So I got some chips and some, we did that when Ifisa was there. We had game night, we had different things, a circle where we talked. And so we did have that. But again, that's when Ifisa was there. So then after that, the Community Health Center, they gave me a bus pass once. They supposed to give me one the next month, no bus pass. They supposed to have bought me a furnace, no furnace. I supposed to have got gift cards to get different stuff. No gift card. Whatever, I received them, potato chips. Oh, I got some potato chips and juice. Yeah, and a bus pass.
Did they give you reasons as to why they didn't you know, give you the things that they said they're going to do?
No. No. No reason. No reason. I got a little bit of attitude, but no reason. So it was so much of attitude, I don't even want to ask for my money.
After speaking with Grady, I brought some of those questions to L. Hammonds, the Community Health Center of Buffalo's chief operating officer. I asked about the current leadership of the Resiliency Center, how effectively it has provided services, and whatever became of Grady's furnace.
So I understand the funding was also to increase staffing. Were there any new hires at the CHCB to help run the Resiliency Center?
Yeah, we did. We did have to hire or allocate, if you will, some staff to help stand up the Resiliency Center and put the infrastructure together. In the beginning, we probably had maybe 5 to 7 staff at the most. And some of the 5 to 7 staff were repurposed from the health center. We took them out of their roles here to serve in the capacity and in the roles to support the Resiliency Center and those victims and the first responders. And then we hired like 2, 3 maybe individuals brand new. We did have a Resiliency Center leader. We had a couple of folks lead that. Right now we're working with, there isn't a person in that role right now. But yeah, that's where the fund, if you're asking specifically on personnel.
Okay, thank you. And so you said, I think you just said something I was going to transition to my next question, that the Resiliency Center currently doesn't have a leader. I've spoken, and this is anecdotally, so if you can confirm whether this is true or not, I'd appreciate it, that there were at least like 3 different directors of the Resiliency Center, that there sort of has been an inconsistency in leadership. Is that true? And if so, can you explain why so many people have been replaced or have left the role or whatever the case may have been?
We've had 3 different directors. There is a person serving in that director role currently. It's a really tough job. You have to have a certain skill set. You have to have a strong administrative skill set and background to be able to handle all the documentation and compliance requirements. But also you have to have a skill set to be able to manage and handle various community programs and community people. You know, it takes a diverse set of skills. And because this is a grant, and it's kind of like a short-term need, it's not a forever thing. It's tough to find the right person, and then we would find people, but then it wasn't sustainable.
So I understand that does happen sometimes. Someone will step into a role and find that they don't have the capacity, you know, to fully fulfill it. And I do wonder, though, and this is not, you know, to question or slight any decision-making by part of the CHCB, but what kind of vetting was done or what kind of requirements were in place? If there were 3 different directors and now there's a search for a 4th one, you know, why is it that there doesn't seem to be anyone who can fully fulfill the roles? Is there a problem with qualifications? Were some folks not honest about what they had the capacity to do? Or do you think the vetting process was not thorough enough?
Well, the vetting process was extremely thorough. I want to reiterate again, Jazz, that we have tremendous oversight. Like, we are not operating in a vacuum. We have the Department of Justice. They have a specific project manager or program manager overseeing everything that we do and helping us vet everything that we do. We had technical assistance advisors fly in from out of town to help give us coaching and advisement. We were not, as the Community Health Center of Buffalo, we were not independently and soloists in the vetting process. And we also had community involvement as part of the process.
So I wanted to talk a little bit more about the assistance that you all do provide in terms of helping out survivors, you know, if they can prove receipt or need for certain services. I spoke with one individual who said that the Resiliency Center would help him with replacing a furnace, but he said he never got that assistance, never got any follow-up when he reached back out. Another survivor said that she didn't receive or couldn't receive mental health services. I just wanted to know what's your response to community members who say that the Resiliency Center isn't fulfilling its promises.
I'd have to know the specific names and situations. I know we have in the past, this is May of 2026, that happened in 2022, as we got further and further away from May 14th, 2022, the federal government, the Department of Justice, if we were to submit a need to replace someone's furnace in, say, 2024, and we couldn't show justifiable documentation of that need 2 years from the event, you know, that we saw some challenges there, but I can't speak to those specific situations.
Okay. I didn't mean, you know, specific cases, because I understand you can't get into the specifics without actually knowing the individuals and, you know, looking at the cases, but I just meant the overall opinion or concern of, you know, what the Resiliency Center is doing, if there were community members who sort of question, you know, how are you doing?
I can tell you this in relation to your question. I think I know where you're going. Is what we've gone through a learning process ourselves with these funds and with operating these funds and operating this grant and helping the victims and first responders. It's really easy, especially with what we do as a community health center of Buffalo, to use these funds to meet the needs of the community. And what we ran into as we had a little bit of scope creep, you know what I mean by scope creep, right?
I'm sorry, I'm unfamiliar with that term.
I'm sorry. So as we expand services based on the needs of the community and based on the desires and the request of the community, if it wasn't, even though we wanted to try to meet those needs, because these are folks that were part of the broader umbrella of what happened, 514, we weren't often able to do that if they weren't specific victims or first responders or families of victims and first responders. So you probably do have people out there who feel like they should have received mental health services or what have you that didn't get them. I know we've been very focused on making sure we meet the needs based on what we can use the funds for.
From Hammond's explanation, the CHCB appears to be running into a familiar tension in operating the Resiliency Center. How to reconcile who the community sees as impacted with who the funding rules defined as eligible? It's a tension we previously observed with the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund, overseen by the National Compassion Fund. Like the Survivors Fund, the Resiliency Center was created to serve people most directly impacted by the tragedy, and it operates within specific parameters for who can receive assistance. This brings me back to the question I originally asked the executive director of the National Compassion Fund. Are people being turned away because they fall outside the rules, or are some people who meet the criteria still being left without services or financial relief? Recently, a group of frustrated residents, witnesses, and survivors of the mass shooting held a forum calling for accountability from the organizations that they feel got the money but aren't delivering.
And that's why they donated so much money in response, right? That's why the Resiliency Center received the $6 million grant in response specifically to the shooting to help these people, to help the people that got just $200.
Ground Zero Speaks was organized by Dominique Calhoun this year, 2 days after the fourth anniversary of 514. She used to live on Laurel Street, just minutes away from the Jefferson Avenue Tops. She's since moved, but the trauma of that day followed her all the way to her new home in Atlanta, Georgia. So did the case itself. Attorneys for the gunman began showing up on the doorsteps of witnesses, asking them how they felt about him facing the death penalty.
Right after that, I needed services. I needed counseling. So I started searching for services. I started searching for counseling. I have two kids who were directly impacted. I needed counseling for them. And you know what I found out? That there was no counseling. There were no services. And then you know what also I found out from speaking to people who were directly impacted? You had people who were evicted immediately after this. You know, so if you have a grant that was supposed to help people that were directly impacted, how do you have people who were dodging bullets inside the grocery store who are evicted directly after this? That should never be.
From this moment of darkness, leaders in the community came together to build something new. A response rooted in compassion, strength, and the determination to make change. This is the story of the Buffalo Together Community Response Fund, a story of healing, of remembrance, and of hope for a future free from hate.
In addition to the Resiliency Center, Dominique took a hard look at Buffalo Together. What were those 86 organizations doing with the grants its steering committee awarded? Who was making sure these groups kept their word? I questioned Garnell Whitfield Jr., a member of the Buffalo Together steering committee, about what kinds of requirements were in place to make sure the awardees didn't just take the money and run. He says there weren't any because the grants served, for the most part, as reimbursement and general support to groups the steering committee noted were already stepping in to assist the community post-tragedy. Many of the funded groups struggled to receive support as it is, he says, and Buffalo Together was meant to break down barriers, not to add more.
That's one of the things that makes it prohibitive for these small organizations to get funding in the first place. The administrative costs, the administrative requirements of reporting back and all of those kinds of things are what inhibits these organizations from being able to scale and meet the needs of our community. So we didn't want to be a part of that process. And we thought it appropriate to help them do what they were already doing and not be a hindrance to that.
Not to take a sort of cynical view here, but how can you trust that these organizations would do the right thing with the money if, you know, there was no requirement to report or to prove that they use the funds to help people and, you know, not for personal gain? Not to say that didn't happen, but unfortunately we've seen instances where it has happened.
Yeah, I mean, in the immediate aftermath of an event such as 514, there's an immediate need by the community. And there are always going to be instances where persons may not have the best interests of the community at heart. That's always going to be the case. But for the most part, we were very confident that the persons that we invested, the entities that we invested in, were doing that work in the community. They were already out there doing that work and did not have funding, did not have support, were paying out of pocket, and were sacrificing much to serve the needs of our community. Those are the persons that we tried to support.
I was curious if that support came with financial guidance, because many of these organizations, as Garnell said, were already operating without stable funding. If Buffalo Together was giving money to nonprofits, especially for community aid, it would make sense for the steering committee to make sure those groups had the help needed to manage it well, right?
There are a few organizations that receive grants that are inactive or, you know, have ceased operations. As you kind of talked about earlier, owning a small business, a nonprofit, whatever the case may be, can be challenging. Financially usually is the number one way. And so some of these organizations have unfortunately folded. A couple of questions. For one, and not to say that this is something that you had to or expected to do, but was there any sort of financial advisory on behalf of Buffalo Together for, you know, to maybe help these folks understand like how to use the funding?
No. Again, we did, those funds that were dispersed were to support efforts that were already underway. You know, going forward, as we develop our capacity, those are things that we want to be able to help our community, you know, organizations and entities with, advising them financially and providing opportunity for them to grow and to, you know, and to scale and to meet the needs of their community and their constituents. And, you know, so right now, many of these groups are small. They're not funded. They can't afford, you know, accountants and all these other things like that, all the things that will be required to be able to apply for grants and those kinds of things. That's the capacity that we're trying to build now. And that's what people don't understand. That did not exist or does not exist within our community. And so the work that we're doing is kind of to some degree groundbreaking and precedent setting in terms of us being able to supply these kinds of opportunities for persons within our community.
Okay, and will you be giving out more grants, or is the rest of the money exclusively for this long-term development plan that you have for the works, in the works for these?
Yeah, again, this is a multifaceted approach. We hope to be able to provide more grants going forward in a sustainable way. These are things that we have to develop and set up foundationally, and so that this is not a one-off. You know, if all of the money was distributed and dispersed, that would be it. Our goal is long-term. And to make sure that this money grows, that we can provide sustainable support over time. And so, yes, grants will be available going forward. They'll be announced at a later date or whatever. But right now, we're trying to build the foundation and the capacity to be able to support all of these different efforts.
Garnell's point was that Buffalo Together was trying to support groups that were already doing the work, groups that had stepped in quickly, often without enough money or institutional backing. But for some survivors and residents, the concern is what happened after those groups received support. At the Ground Zero Speaks Forum, Dolores Jackson, whom you met in the previous episode, was among the people still asking whether the organizations that received money in the name of recovery actually followed through for the people they were supposed to serve.
I just feel like at this juncture, I've been with three organizations who said they was gonna provide for my mental wellness, and they don't know me. They dropped the ball on my dental appointment. Only a dental appointment, okay?
Julie Harwell was at the forum too. She's a survivor whose story has reached national audiences. And in the year since May 14th, she has been asked again and again to share what happened to her and how the attack continues to affect her and her children, specifically her daughter London, who was just 8 years old at the time.
I'm like the poster child, basically. Like, my daughter was in there. Like, I didn't know if she was alive or not. The father of my child was there. He hid her in the freezer while I was running from my life. People don't know how hard it is. Every year, I don't hear from none of these people until this day come.
In a one-on-one phone conversation I had with Julie, she explained how her life changed, what assistance she did receive, and what help she still hasn't gotten. She was found eligible to receive compensation from the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund as a witness who experienced psychological trauma, but those funds took nearly 2 years to reach her. She also received help with a security deposit through the Resiliency Center. But none of the assistance was substantial or timely enough to help her get back on her feet or provide some sense of normalcy and stability for her children. Julie continues to struggle, not only financially, but mentally. She told me that she sought mental health services through a number of funded organizations and programs, but what pains Julie the most is the impact that day had on London and the fact that her daughter hasn't benefited from the donations that were given in her name. She repeated these sentiments at the Ground Zero Speaks Community Conference.
It's crazy to me because I haven't got help for my daughter. No scholarship for her. Like, nobody reached out to her. No nothing.
Early promises, not just from organizations, but from donors, included commitments to invest in the futures of children and young adults in the area. An early Buffalo Business First report quoted developer Doug Jamal as pledging at least $100,000 for living expenses, funeral expenses, or, quote, even helping to put your kids through college, end quote. Fellow developer Greg Daniel was reported as making a pledge to match Jamal's gift, though Daniel's gift was reported to specifically help the families of the victims. As for where their donations actually went, I couldn't tell you. I reached out numerous times to both Jamal and Daniel, but I never received a response from either. There was also a scholarship established in the name of Lieutenant Aaron Salter, the top supermarket bodyguard who was murdered while trying to defend the lives of others.
He survived almost 30 years of being a police officer in Buffalo. So to get killed at a grocery store on a second job as a security guard is ridiculous.
An organization called Legacy 514 was formed to honor the retired Buffalo police officer's memory. It received a $100,000 donation from Paddock Chevrolet and a $500 contribution from Canisius University to a scholarship named for Lieutenant Salter. The Legacy 514 website, now only accessible through webpage archives, also had a link where people could make donations online. In 2023, Legacy 514 made a $50,000 investment in the lives of 10 students 1 year after the mass shooting, awarding each student a $5,000 scholarship. The organization's public activity appears to have slowed after 2023, though related scholarship fundraisers continued into the following year. Known events include the 514 5K and Half Marathon, sponsored by the Lieutenant Aaron Salter Memorial Scholarship, as well as a celebrity gala and golf tournament, hosted by Hall of Fame defensive end and Buffalo Bills legend Bruce Smith. The address for Legacy 514 was listed as 34 Benwood Avenue, also the address of the Community Health Center of Buffalo. It's unclear what affiliation, if any, the organization had or still has with the health center. From food access to mental health, emergency assistance, scholarships, and community investment, so many public commitments were made in the name of recovery. Mark Talley, whose mother Geraldine Talley was killed on May 14th, is among those who feel there hasn't been much action behind those words. Mark has been a vocal critic of the way that tragic day has been publicly reframed each year. In his words, Buffalo treats 514 like its favorite holiday. But underneath that criticism is an even deeper concern, that some organizations and individuals have been elevated by the tragedy, while the people most affected are still waiting for meaningful change.
There are a lot of organizations and probably people, you know, they profited off the community's pain. You know, you had a lot of people and organizations who benefited financially or even reputationally from 514 who were nowhere to be found before or after. You have organizations and people who were able to build entire brands, programs, even campaigns, you know, off of tragedy. Meanwhile, the community and the people who lived there, who were directly impacted, were left and are still left navigating the trauma, the bills, the pain, the instability, along with all the broken promises and disconnect is something the city still hasn't reckoned with.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and just doing some of my research, looking into some organizations and what they promised, you know, there were promises of, like, mental health support, of more greater food access, even things with just, like, helping with, you know, rent or expenses for people who are impacted. But it seems, and what I've heard from some survivors, you know, they haven't gotten that. Do you know of anyone who looks to be actually delivering on the services that they promised?
I mean, it's here and there, but it's not actually stability. It's more one-off here and there type things when there's events in the community, when the priority should have always been long-term stability for the people in these neighborhoods. You know, whether that means, like you said, housing, mental health support, some type of economic investment or resources that strengthen families. And unfortunately, you know, it's become PR projects or symbolic gestures. And a lot of the money that was raised, you know, a lot of that money went toward things that looked good publicly, but really didn't shift anything structurally for the people who really needed it in that area.
What's your thought on just, you know, like how the money was dispersed and how it should have been dispersed to have the greatest impact to actually help people?
I mean, it should have went dispersed to the people in the area who have boots on the ground and doing things on a consistent basis that needed this money to be structurally and foundationally sound. Instead of like most things, the money went to nonprofits and organizations who already have all of this. And they held on to that money and, you know, unfortunately, they try to give little grants to other nonprofits and keep the majority of it.
That disillusionment Mark and others have expressed comes from a lack of transparency and accountability involving the distribution of funds. Some of the nonprofits that received major grants in response to 514 have lost momentum and aren't as publicly active as they were 4 years ago. Some announced they were ceasing operations altogether. Some face challenges with their nonprofit status, raising questions about oversight and eligibility. That doesn't mean there was mass fraud or misappropriation of funds. Some organizations that were structurally and financially unstable to begin with may not have been sustainable, even with donations and grants. In Buffalo, there have been a few notable cases of organizations facing tax-exempt status issues tied to administrative filing errors. But even if there was no ill intent, that doesn't erase the larger issue that community members like Grady are still looking for the help they were promised, the help they saw millions of dollars devoted to providing. When I asked him what he feels changed within his community following 514, Grady's answer shed light on another reason organizational help is difficult to measure. How do you track whether organizations are keeping their word when they're not even present in the communities they're supposed to serve?
There's a lot of different organizations. Because I know one of the places I volunteer at, Cold Spring Community Foundation, they told me they received a $5,000 grant. And I was like, okay, cool, because y'all feeding people and they give great meals. So I heard about, well, I've seen a list of different organizations, and I'm like, is any of these places around here? Like, so yeah, I haven't seen no change.
And that brings the story to a deeper question. To what degree were survivors and community members given a seat at the table when it came to who got funding and how those dollars should have been used in their neighborhoods? Much of the early decision-making after 514 was shaped by steering committees, commissions, and organizations created to manage different forms of relief. For some of those efforts, like the CHCB's Resiliency Center, leaders say community involvement helps structure where and how to invest resources to serve those most impacted. At least, that's what the health center's chief operating officer told me.
There were assessments done, and we had care coordinators and care outreach people in that one block radius of the incident to really assess and evaluate what the needs were. Primarily, they were mostly the listening sessions, and what we did was with the families, the victims' families, and their first responders. It was very restricted. It wasn't this wide open, like town hall open forum. It was very, and this was as directed by the Department of Justice, is to have the listening sessions and do the assessments and all that, specifically with the victims, victims' families, and first responders.
Some other organizations that emerged after 514 say they're trying to bring the community closer to the decision-making process, especially when it comes to long-term investment. Garnell says that was one of Buffalo Together's biggest goals.
As far as money, investments, land acquisitions, partnerships, all of these things are going to this long-term Eastside investment plan. The steering committee will make the decision.
Yes, that's with the input from the community. So we're not doing it in a vacuum. We are engaging with the community to, you know, determine what their priorities are, what their needs are, and then we will move forward based on that.
Okay, and are you holding any sort of community meetings?
There's been community meetings held. We have a website that people can access. And so, yes, there's been several community meetings held. There's been surveys and different things done. And so we'll continue to do that as we gear up, as we you know, start to implement this plan. There will be more interaction with the community.
But the community's tired of the conversations because after 4 years, remembrance without repair can start to feel performative, some say. Mark Talley says the work now is to cut through the press conferences, titles, and public narratives and ask the questions some institutions still haven't answered.
No, I think it's either you have to find the gap between what was promised and what was delivered, and refusing to let people hide behind, you know, their fancy titles, PR, or good intentions. You know, you have to find out where did the money go, who made these decisions, who benefited, who didn't. You have to have people show you the numbers and not necessarily the narrative. You know, I don't really care no more regarding how many press conferences to talk about 514, how many shirts, murals, or hashtags someone has produced. I don't care if once this summer comes and we have the annual Thursday or Friday things on Jefferson and constantly talking about 514 and how people need help. There's no point in talking about it if no one's getting help. So we have to find out when this money was donated, how many families got support, how much of this money got, you know, investment in the East Side. Unfortunately, people don't have these answers. So I say, for me, it's just you have to start calling things out and putting a name to it.
That brings us back to Ground Zero Speaks, where Dominique and others impacted by 514 are strategizing to put ownership and oversight back into the hands of the community.
If you live within that Jefferson community, you should have been assisted. We all should have been assisted. If you lived on the East Side, as much money as came in, we all should have been assisted at this point, okay? So we need to understand what came in so we won't go down this road again. Because yes, we can point fingers, we can say, this is not working, that is not working, but we need to try to get some framework so that we can know how we can build.
Some view the aftermath of the mass shooting as a hard lesson learned in staying vigilant, accounting for how streams of funding are dispersed and making sure every dollar gets into the right hands. Organizers say education can help with that.
Knock on wood, pray to God we don't have anything that happens like this again. But they're going to garnish us and raise more money. They're going to use our stories, our face, our likeness, poverty, right? And they're going to get funds. But we need to understand how funds come in, how they're allocated, what they're there for, what a restricted fund is. If it comes from the state, it's for gun violence initiative, it shouldn't be going to anybody that's not doing gun violence initiative, okay? And that's just the bottom line, because they're taking out of people's mouths who not being paid adequately because they don't get funding.
Residents around Jefferson Avenue and members of Buffalo's Black community more broadly didn't simply lose something on May 14th, 2022. They were robbed. Robbed of 10 lives. Robbed of security. Robbed of normalcy. And now, some worry the urgency, attention, and resources that poured into Buffalo after the attack are slowly slipping further from the people they were meant to help. As you can tell from the stories you've heard, these residents aren't looking for a payout. They're looking for people to deliver on their promises and for a clear accounting of the money that did not go directly to victims' families, survivors, or the community. We've explored how the money came in, and we've been able to pinpoint a few places and people who received it. But there are still more questions than answers. The overarching question, where do we go from here with what we've been able to learn? This involves taking a look at how we got here in the first place, and by here, I mean pre-514 Black Buffalo. We'll take a look at past and present and learn about what some community members are hoping to see for the future. But not everyone's hoping. Some are taking action through asking tough questions, through community mobilization, and even through legal recourse. I hope you'll join me next time for the third and final installment of Where Did the Money Go? A What's Next special from BTPM NPR. I'm Ijaz Jasil. Thank you for listening.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.